Welcome to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Radio, licensed in Bella Vista, California, and transmitting from Round Mountain. Here we explore the lives of triumphant humans who endure life's persistent challenges. Our guests are driven by passion and inspiration and live with a compelling sense of purpose. Their persistence, perseverance are brought on by tragic episodes or by wonderfully cradled lives. But for whatever reasons, guests will openly share their innermost feelings and beliefs that fuel their works. Please listen to these inspirational, triumphant human stories. And yes, I am Henry Cuenca. Today's guest defines herself as a mother of three and a citizen of the world. Born and raised in a Northern California hamlet and removed from the big city influences, she sought broader horizons and went on to graduate from Stanford University with a master's degree in international policy studies and a bachelor's in international relations from Principa College. She is conversant in five languages, served as a United States CIA officer, and served in war-torn area of Iraq and the Middle East, and working with the U.S. Marines. One of her earliest childhood memories was wanting to become a mommy. And mommy she has become, but on a much larger scale. You see, Janessa's inspiration came from witnessing the horrific sight of children's toys and shoes jumbled amongst skeletal remains of mass graves. This led her to founding an international peace organization called Euphrates International. Please listen to this heartfelt story. Janessa Gaines Wilder, welcome to today's show.
Thank you, Henry. So great to be here. I love that bringing up of the wanting to be the mommy with CIA. It kind of doesn't always go together, but it does.
Janessa, you defined yourself as a mother of three and a citizen of the world. That's a really broad scope. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, I think, well, the mommy of three part's easy. I have three adorable children, 5, 3, and 1, 2 girls and a boy. And they really just ground me in that sense of purity and innocence. And what is all this life about? And what is this work for? And it's for future generations. It's for the legacy we leave our children and grandchildren. So they've really grounded me in that sense of love and just purpose. And then for me, being a citizen of the world, I think it was first traveling at young ages. I did grow up here in Reading, but my parents really sought out opportunities to be exposed to other places. And my first trip abroad was to Mexico when I was 7. We spent the whole summer there. Then when I was 12,
that's
my
why
parents,
you like Mexican food, right?
I could eat it every day, every meal. And at 12, you know, they sent me for a year to live abroad. So I think just that early sense of, wow, I'm a part of something bigger. There's a whole world out there. I love where I live. I love Reading and all the beauty. And just it was home. It will always be home. But then there was also an appreciation for how much there is out there and how much we're connected to all of it.
Mm-hmm. So you have a very broad perspective on things. And I know that Euphrates International is a worldwide organization. You have chapters throughout the world. And so tell us about Euphrates. Tell us about
that.
Yeah,
I would describe it as a grassroots global peace-building organization. Mm-hmm. And what's most amazing to me, we have over 30 chapters in 15 countries, but it's the chance to work with these men and women who are truly on the front lines of violence in their countries and are these emissaries for peace. You know, each one in their own community is trying to, as our tagline says, turn the other into a brother. So what is the source of conflict in Pakistan, in India, in Cote d'Ivoire, you know, all of these places where our chapters are? Excuse me. What is the source of that? What's driving the division between people? Why can't Muslims and Hindus get along in India? why are these warring tribes in conflict in Côte d'Ivoire? So really looking at that, and then these folks are brave enough to go right into that conflict and start dialogue between disparate groups and go visit the other in Liberia. One of our chapter members, he was the first Christian to go visit the mosque in town mm-hmm. with a group to engage them and listen to them and hear their stories. And they said, "You're welcome anytime. We're so grateful. Now we feel included. We feel part of this community." So it just, to me, you know, getting to work with this community is really what Euphrates is. It's a community of these peace builders around the world who are on the front lines of extremism and violence, and yet who are bridging those divides and engaging in dialogue and creating circles of peace. And what we hope is that as you connect those different circles happening around the world, that we grow stronger. We grow stronger in connection to one another and in community. We learn from each other. We exchange best practices, ideas, and inspiration, and that one person doesn't feel so isolated anymore. Mm-hmm. Yes, they're maybe the only one in their community doing this work, but as you connect to this global community, you feel a sense of solidarity, and you're not only learning from them, that you feel like, okay, I can keep going one more day doing my work here in Reading because I know all these other folks around the world are continuing to do their work. And there's just some strength in that and willingness to persevere because we're not in it alone.
How do you diffuse the issues that we've experienced in the time that you have spent in Iraq and the Middle East? How do you diffuse a war or a challenge against Iraq? I mean, how do you do that? How does your vision diffuse those sort of confrontations that are just the worst things in the world that can happen?
Yeah.
And we have those going on all over the world right now, Yemen, and we have Syria is big enough for you. How do you actually, when the rubber hits the road, how do we diffuse those things?
Well,
or your organization? What
yeah.
is the vision of your organization to diffuse those time bombs?
Well, I think there are different levels. And I went into government thinking it had to be top down. It had to be, you know, we're going to stop this war with military, or we're going to put pressure on this, you know, through this policy. And there is a role for that. I mean, think of the power and the might and the funding and all of that of the U.S. government. And so, but what I found in Iraq is that even with all of that, even with that huge power, immense potency of the U.S. government, all, you know, the trillions of dollars.
I mean, you were CIA agent.
Yeah.
So you were part of that. Yeah.
And what I realized is that it didn't actually change anything. You know, dictatorship is a change of the heart, a change of the mind. You can't just say overnight, we are moving from a dictatorship and voila, we are a democracy. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have elections and a constitution. So unless you really work to change people's hearts and minds, it's just a piece of paper. It doesn't really exist. It's not embedded
with brutality
in the
and money going channeling, feeding those things.
That's right. It was the same dictatorship mentality that was operating now in the guise of a democracy. So I really realized that absolutely nothing will change, even if we put in new leaders, even if we stop a war, even unless it's true transformation, which is a change of the spirit, change of the heart and the mind. And how do you do that? You can't do that with a military. You have to do that one person at a time, the painstakingly slow, arduous process of personal transformation through education, through a sense of safety, of people being safe enough to embrace new ideas, to challenge old beliefs and perceptions, and to grow. And so that, I realized that work happens at the grassroots, and that's why Euphrates is focused on grassroots transformation. But it's hard to do that, right? One, how do you show the effect? How do you measure that in terms of quantifiable results? It might take 10 years before someone is transformed. So that's
if ever.
Exactly. If ever, even in our lifetime.
Bin Laden would have never surrendered.
I mean, you never know, but
well,
right?
I mean, like,
there's
actually
certain
you're
people
right,
you can kind of write off, but
yeah, yeah.
But one hopes that you're never lost. But it's just that you have to trust that the work at the grassroots will eventually have an impact. And there's one study that I cling to for hope. And this is a study out of Stanford University from Everett Rogers. And he found, he studied hundreds and hundreds of case studies of how major social change happened. And what he found is that it really does start at the grassroots. And once you have 2% of the population who are visionaries, who see the potential of a new idea and really voice that idea, and then you reach about 5% of the population are early adopters. What he found in each of these case studies is between 5 and 20% of the population, once they've adopted a new idea, let's say democracy rather than dictatorship, it hits a turning point. Sometimes it was 5.5%, sometimes it was 19.75%, but always between 5 and 20% of the population, it hits that turning point.
What a remarkable idea.
Yeah. So, and then it reaches everyone. And so even the late adopters. And what he found was the late adopters were usually those in government, usually those in positions of power and influence. So I'm like, you know what? Just don't bother with the late adopters. Go where the energy is. Go where people have the vision for change. They're early adopters who are hungry for transformation. So that's our work. And what we hope is we'll eventually hit that tipping point and then and then it will happen.
So in other words, if you marched, and I'm being a CIA agent for the number of years, which was 6 years, I believe.
5 years.
Five years, okay. I imagine that you still have connections with the Pentagon and CIA. And so you couldn't ring the doorbell and say, I'm here to talk to you about a fresh idea.
You know, a lot of my former colleagues, they love the work we're doing and you know,
well, they
good,
have to.
Good for you for getting
but
out.
They would have to.
Yeah.
Whether they're hard militants or not, the concept has to be embraced and recognized by everybody, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're a jihadist, right?
Right.
Right. And that may take a different approach and different timeline. But all of us here in this country would line up for you. There's no question about that.
I mean, who doesn't want peace, right?
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
Right.
And I've found that some of our biggest allies are folks in the military who, you know, they're the ones putting their lives on the line for our ideals. And it's like, wow, if we could stop the conflict from, you know, work on the preventative side, stop it from happening in the first place to avoid them having to risk their lives, to not come home to their families, to lose limbs. It's in their best interest, and they're the biggest advocates for the State Department. You know, our current Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, was the main person arguing to preserve the State Department's budget against Trump. He said, this is critical work because the work of diplomacy, the work of peace building is keeping our men and women safe. It's preventative. And so I think there's just such tremendous alliance there between our folks in defense and our peacebuilding groups. We all want the same thing, and it's just about maybe reallocating those resources a little bit.
Sure.
You know, one tank could fund thousands of peacebuilders
right.
in this work, and so do we really need all the trillions of dollars that are spent on our wars? You know, we're always asking that question, why is war a trillion-dollar industry and everyone in the peace-building field is struggling, you know, is poor? So let's redistribute.
You had told me earlier that our current strategy is like collecting drops from a bucket, right?
Yeah, it seems.
Tell us about that.
Sure. So, as a counterinsurgency analyst, you know, we'd have our target list and that we were working from in Iraq, and so we'd get someone, and then it seemed like for every person we got, 10 more would fill his place. And I just had this. I just realized, oh my gosh, this is like catching drops of water from a leaky faucet. You know, great, you catch that drop of water, but here it comes. It's a leaky faucet. It's never going to end. And so the question in my mind was, how do we fix the faucet? How do we really stop this at its root? All this energy, all this money, all these lives being lost, catching
terrible.
Each drop of water, and it's not fixing the problem.
Not at all.
So it really, caused me to try to go deeper and to investigate those deeper root causes.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, the experience that you spend in the Middle East and Iraq and in the actual war zones built up to this crescendo of your vision. And I wonder if you could tell us about some of the most prominent experiences that you had in Iraq.
Yeah, well, there was such a turning point for me about a year into my service there, and I had been working as a counterinsurgency analyst, and it was a crescendo. That's a really great way to term it, because Fallujah happened, where really what happened is that four of our American guards, they were Blackwater guards, were strung up and mutilated.
Do you remember that image
on the bridge? Just mm-hmm.
They
so
were hung up from the bridge.
Terrifying.
Right.
They'd been burned and mutilated, strung up on the bridge, and so we wanted to respond to this as U.S. government. So we launched a major attack on Fallujah. And so I was brought out there to the base that was outside on the outskirts of Fallujah to support that effort. And that was the closest I'd ever been to the front lines. And I was sleeping
in a tent. That's close
enough for me. Yeah, definitely close enough. You know, it was constant incoming and outgoing mortars and rockets. And it was deafening noise. And I was sleeping in a tent with six other guys. And we had our weapons right there. You know, had to go back and forth to the sandbags and outside our tent, and it was a dark, dark time. It was just depressing. It felt like so much despair, seeing our guys coming back wounded from the field, and just so wanting to put an end to this conflict at this, looking at this major loss of life, and it just felt very dark. And actually, I remember this moment. It was Good Friday was the worst of it, and I called my dad from the satellite phone. Mm-hmm. I said, it's just so horrible. I can't even bear it. And I hadn't slept, you know, for days and days. And he made some comment about, well, it's Good Friday. And I said, oh, my gosh. And being a spiritual person, you know, wow, it's the night that Jesus died on the cross. You know, he just took everything out of him. He gave everything for, you know, for Jesus, even sacrificed his life. And just, you know, thinking about this loss of life, and I thought, it can't get any worse than this. This is Good Friday.
That's
the worst. That
yeah,
is the
precisely.
That is the lowest. And somehow just that realization of maybe this is as bad as it can get. And it did turn around, at least for me. You know, Easter came. We celebrated it in a chapel. I was there side by side with our Marines and all bowing our heads together in gratitude, and that there would be a light on the horizon. And there was just, you know, even in the midst of that, I knew there had to be some hope. So anyway, about a month after that, I was along the river, and Euphrates River, and that's where I really saw that vision of hope, that I realized that beautiful vision of peace and stillness flowed right in the midst of the war zone. And the thought that came was, which is more powerful, this life force of peace and stillness or the bombs going off? And everything in me in that moment said, I choose the river.
Like
and,
an epiphany almost,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It really was. It was a declaration. It was taking a stand mm-hmm. for that. I didn't even know what that meant, I choose the river. But it meant I choose life and peace. And so we went back. I told my boss to I wanted to stop doing counterinsurgency, and I immediately switched over to working on the elections and human rights, a complete opposite of what I'd been
oh,
doing.
Oh, my goodness sakes. Transformation moment, right. We're going to have to take a break from this wonderful story that you're telling us. And so we're going to be back in just a really short time as we take our break. If you are just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5 FM, listener-supported radio. And I'm Henry Cuenca, and my guest today is our wonderful, very emotional speaker, telling us about her vision of international peace organization, and Janessa Ganswilder. We're going to continue now. So you have a basic inspiration, right?
Absolutely.
Change, transition of heart. And that is a pre-step to formulation of your institution. Tell us about your institution now.
Yeah, well, as I said, you know, with my own transformation that I experienced in Iraq, I thought how great if other people could experience this, you know, to go from seeing people as the enemy, as the other, you know, as almost not even human, to working side by side. And that's what I had done, going from counterinsurgency, you know, taking them out on the target list, to sitting on the same side of the table, working together for a vision for Iraq, working together to solve problems. So if I could have that transformation, wouldn't it be great if other people could also gain that appreciation of whoever their other is? You know, is it Arabs in the Middle East? Is it different religion, different skin color, different gender? You know, we have so much othering going on in our society. So that's really at the heart of Euphrates, is as we try to turn the other into a brother, it's how are we doing that in all of these communities? And then all these communities, as we come together, we can do that even more effectively. We
Certainly.
Can grow from each other and learn from each other.
And you have, currently, you have about 30 chapters. In how many countries?
15 countries.
Tell us about your organization. A little bit more detail on your organization.
Yeah, so we host a lot of workshops for our chapters, skills building, community calls. We just had one this morning where it's so great to see the faces of these folks from all over the world. They give updates on what events they're planning in their communities. So, for example, in the Congo, our chapter leader there is really helping.
Africa is
in the Congo and Africa, he's bringing albinos and non-albinos together. So albinos albinos are a really discriminated population in the Congo.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. And also he's bringing deaf and hearing populations together. So those folks with those kinds of disabilities.
What a fresh, innovating approach.
Right.
My goodness sakes. That's life-changing.
Absolutely. So they'll bring them together for music, for dialogue. They teach them how to do dialogue. What does that mean to just appreciate? You know, the pictures are amazing. They're looking into each other's eyes. And this is a population that's kind of untouchable. You know, you don't associate with them. And witchcraft is obviously, if they turned out that way, there's just really discriminated against, acts of violence against them. So things like that, it's different in every chapter. It's hard to even generalize. We have a high school chapter in Flint, Michigan that is doing wonderful work to embrace the Muslim community in Michigan, which is a large part of the minority population there, trying to educate their peers in high school about that faith, going to visit local mosques and writing letters of appreciation. And so it's such a diverse community, all trying to bring more dialogue, more peace into their communities, but in very unique ways.
That's beautiful. Now, you have a trip planned here in a couple of weeks. You're going to the Middle East and Palestine.
Yeah.
Tell us about your trip and what your objectives are and who you're meeting with.
So I'm leading a group of students, college students, and it's going to be I'm paired up with a religion professor. So he's going to be looking at all the past, you know, the Bible stories and walking on the land that Jesus trod and the land of the prophets. And then I'm going to be looking at, that's great that healing and amazing transformation happened 2,000 years ago, but what needs healing right now, today? And inspiring these students to take a look at sort of what would Jesus do in modern day Israel and Palestine. Here is in just such an intractable conflict that has been going on for decades and so the source of so much suffering. Well, let's investigate that. What is at the root of that? Why can't they get along? You know, why can't any of us get along? What is the root of violence, of conflict in our own lives, in our own communities? And then how can we be a part in supporting the healing that needs to take place here in the Middle East? So I really want them to connect that this isn't just a great historical tour of fascinating religious places, but this is a modern day religious or spiritual dilemma that we all need to be a part of.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be meeting with grassroots peace building groups, looking at all the amazing work that they're doing on the ground to find that common ground. And it's amazing. Their stories don't make it in the news, but it is remarkable, remarkable examples of turning others into brothers and practicing true forgiveness. And we wish it could just be amplified around the world.
Well, it sounds like you are turning up the volume on this whole situation. You speak five languages.
I'm conversant in five languages.
Well, I don't know the difference.
Well, as I learned each new one, the other one sort of went out the other side. So at one time, I lived in Germany. I did a study abroad there. I was, nearly fluent in German. I was definitely fluent in, I've always been fluent in French because I lived there, and in Spanish, and then in Arabic. And so as each new one, though, I would get totally immersed living abroad and only speaking that language, that it was so hard to be able to speak the other ones at the same time. So it's sort of like I'm a one language at a time person.
Well,
I think if I went back to those countries, it would come back.
You'd pick it up.
But it's right. Just, it's hard to switch.
You have your very first international gathering of your universe, your chapters, here in Reading in the spring. This is the first time, and I know that there's got to be enormous excitement of gathering people from all over the world that have the same passion that that founded this your vision. So tell us about who's coming and what is on the agenda.
It's technology today is so incredible in that it enables us to communicate via Zoom. And, you see people online and you connect and you talk, but there's nothing like being in someone's presence. So while it's been amazing that we can, foster this community with our technology, it will be the first time that we are all together. And there's a tremendous power in that. I think as the world becomes more digitized and more disconnected, we need even more in-person connection to keep us going and to strengthen that. So, number one on the agenda is being together, hearing each other's stories, deeply listening to one another, crying together, understanding these remarkable paths that each of them on and the work that they're doing is exhausting and tiring. And we just need to really create a safe space for that. And then also to learn together. Lots of workshops, building skills, learning new tools for peace building, for dialogue, hearing inspiring speakers, and really reflecting on that so everyone can feel strengthened and emboldened and equipped to go back and be more effective global citizens.
And how many conferencees do you anticipate coming?
We have room for 75, so we are going to put the invitations out there, and we really hope that anyone's welcome to apply. And then we're also doing a gala at the Sheraton at the end, and that's like a big party where anyone can come and learn about Euphrates and join in on that, and that can be hundreds of people. So,
The entire community essentially is going to be invited to attend this gala.
Absolutely.
Would some of your international guests Would this be the first time that they've traveled to?
Yes. Yeah, we have five of our scholarship winners from other countries, and it will be the first time that they've set foot on an airplane, that they've left their home country. And imagine coming to Reading.
The United States,
time.
Right? United
yeah,
States.
Leaving the Ivory Coast, the Congo, Cameroon,
and you've
Liberia.
Been in all of these places.
No, I have not been to any of those places.
Really?
Yeah. Huh?
Actually, so your meetings countries. are going to be the first mm-hmm. time meetings.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is obviously a very, very exciting, worthy event that you're putting on.
Yeah, it really feels just so sacred in a way. To bring. I cannot wait for you to meet the caliber of these people. Just the most morally courageous and incredibly inspiring. And so, one of them would be incredible, right? But then bringing all of them together.
Remarkable.
And the power of that. And,
remarkable.
You can just kind of imagine this impulse on the world, this drop in this lake of the ripple effects could be mm-hmm.
Well,
so
they
huge
will be. They
coming
will be
that.
Huge. Yeah. And you have a visionary of the year. That is going to come up to this event. Tell us about your Visionary of the Year.
Yes. Well, so this year's Visionary of the Year is one of our chapter leaders, James mm-hmm. Ofu from the Ivory Coast, and he will be coming.
Uh-huh.
He's one of those folks who never left his home country, an incredible peace builder, the only one to bring peace to two warring tribes in Ivory Coast where everyone else was too afraid to touch this conflict, and he went right in there. So he's going to be in attendance. And then 2019's Visionary of the Year, which we just approved as a board, will be Nipun Mehta, who's the founder of Service Space, an organization of over 500,000 volunteers. They're all...
Really?
Yes. He even is a full-time volunteer, and they really are about amplifying the spirit of generosity in humanity, which we all are wired for generosity.
Well, of
and yet
we are.
Our structures and, you know, everything doesn't really help us live that way, but they are really furthering generosity and acts of service. And so he will deliver a rousing talk, and just it's wonderful that he'll be here with us for the whole time.
Janessa, we have to take another break right now. So you're listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Supported Radio, 88.5 FM. And I'm Henry Cuenca, and we're going to take a real short break and be right back. Welcome back, my listeners, and we're having a very, very inspirational meeting here with Janessa Gans-Wilder, and certainly a passion-filled vision that she holds. But in our show, we like to connect the dots to people's lives to kind of line up the experiences that people had in their lives to compel them to do the kind of work that they're doing. So, Janessa, you're doing a beautiful job, beautiful work, and beautiful explanation of your institution and your vision. And I want to take you back to childhood, right? You were born in Reading.
Yeah.
Tell us about your childhood.
Well, I grew up with two other brothers. Some parents are not from Reading, but they moved here in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And I think my childhood, I mean, everyone, right? The childhood is our roots for our lives. I think growing up with two very different brothers, my oldest brother, 4 years older, was just... you know, could do everything, a major jock, super smart, and all the ladies loved him. You know, he was just the golden child. And he then went on to go to the Naval Academy, was a Navy SEAL for 10 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And is now in the military industry. He mm-hmm. works for a top Israeli military. So he's selling weapons while I'm selling peace.
do you meet somewhere?
And yet we share. Yes, we really do. He sees that this work uh-huh. is actually just the other night. He said, you know, I'm sorry. I've never told you this before. I so admire and
this
respect
your brother
telling
you this.
My oldest brother, who's never actually voiced that he has supported my work, never, you know, asked me about Euphrates. And he just said, I'm...
And you've been at Euphrates for 7, 8 years, right?
More like 10 or 12.
Oh, and he never approached it. Wow.
Never.
Wow. Interesting.
And, yeah. I had no idea. And he said, I'm so sorry. I've never told you this. I have so respect. You know, you've got more courage than anyone in special ops. And, you know, coming from him, who was a lieutenant commander in the SEALs and... for all these, you know, SEAL Team 7, which is the most secretive, and it meant so much to me because I really do see the tie that we're both on the same side. We're both wanting, you know, just we fulfill different roles in that. So that was huge. But he, you know, he was always this looming larger than life brother. And then my other brother, 2 years older, is with special needs, very developmentally disabled, mentally retarded, can't talk at all, severe autism.
He was born this way.
Yeah, uh-huh. He was born this
way. And he's older than you?
He's older than me, but I babysat him a lot. Uh-huh. You know, just starting from an early age, I was really, I just was always wanting to take care of him. There was a lot going on in my family, you know, parents trying to make ends meet and just a lot of struggles and a lot of dysfunction, I would say, in the family. And then here's this brother who, you know, here's my mom working so hard as a high school teacher, my dad working, and who's taking care of
David,
my brother. Mm-hmm. So I think, and then seeing how other people treated him as almost just an untouchable, you know, they were either scared of him or they made fun of him, or even family members were violent towards him. And yet he was just this most pure, innocent, unconditionally loving, just precious, precious soul. And anyone who looked past his exterior would get to see that and get to know him. And that to me
he couldn't speak. Isn't that correct?
No. Yeah. Can
he speak now?
Nope.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Nothing whatsoever. He knew a few signs and sign language, but cannot communicate. And imagine how hard that is for a person. You know, so sometimes he would act out, but really just out of frustration that he couldn't make his needs known, and to just, you know, live in that silence would be so hard.
So you spent quite a bit of time working with him, or spending time with him, right? Because
Absolutely.
Of his complete, total disability. And I'm wondering, what impact did that have on you now? I mean, looking back on your life and recalling all the experience of working and loving your brother, what impact did he have on you? Or his condition and him?
Yeah, I mean... Early on, I remember thinking I needed to take advantage of every opportunity because David couldn't. So I, you know, wanted to push myself and do all kinds of things because he would never have those opportunities. But really, he just opened my heart that no one's better than the other. We're all human beings. We all have such value. I mean, because what he taught me, he was such a teacher for me. He was so non-judgmental. He was so loving. He was so pure. He was just had so much to teach, and yet people discounted him. So I think he just taught me that we're all, you know, even if we look different, there's no other. Mm-hmm. We're all brothers, you know, and so people looked at him as an other, but to me, he was my brother.
And obviously still is.
And yeah, exactly right. He is my brother. And that's how I think humanity is, that we are all one family. We are all in this together. And everything teaches us that, not only the spiritual teachings, but you look at the blue dot floating in space. You know, we are all inhabitants of this one tiny planet. We are all connected.
What a perspective you carry, really.
Just the oneness is reality.
Tell us about your parents.
So, they had a global outlook. They grew up traveling, which is interesting. And my mom became a Spanish teacher. My dad spent a lot of high school in Europe. And so I think that kind of appreciation for international perspectives was passed on to me. And both deeply supportive and caring folks. My dad in the financial industry and my mom as a teacher, as I said, and just they supported whatever crazy dreams I had or adventures. They never said no. They said, that's great. You know, Jess, you go ahead and do that. Whatever it was, even going to Iraq. Mm-hmm. Okay, honey, have fun.
Boy, I'll bet you there's every parent in the world who had a child going to Iraq would say no. Right?
I know. Well, but these are also parents who, when I was 12 years old and barely had turned 12, sent me to France for a year, an entire year, and I never saw them, and they didn't know the family.
And how you were how old?
I was 12.
12 years old. Pretty young.
Very young. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, and they didn't know the family I was going to be staying with. I got on the plane, and I did not see them for 365 days.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
Yeah. So I think they were just really, really trusting that they could just, like, what parent would do that?
Precisely. Well, you set yourself off at a very young age by also winning the Fiddler Award at four. Did I read this correctly? Four, or was that 14?
No, it was 4 years
age
old.
Four, you won the national?
Well, in my age group, so who knows how many other kids.
Well, but still, it's still.
Yeah,
right?
I was the youngest filler, so I was a national fiddle champion or whatever for at four, and I got to be on national television, which was great, and to play a song, which I totally messed up.
What song did you play?
Boil the Cabbage.
We should have played that as our theme song, Lily.
So, but I'm glad they captured first. I don't remember it.
All I remember is
bright lights on a stage. But I'm so glad that somehow it got recorded, because then, you know, it's amazing to see that.
So you had great influences by your parents on music, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, playing everyone on my mom's side is a musician. Everyone. My aunt plays 10 instruments. My other aunt was on Hee Haw. My grandmother went to Juilliard.
Oh, my goodness.
Mom plays in three orchestras. Everything is about music on that side of the family. Their motto is, the family that plays together stays together.
Well, it worked, didn't it? So your mother currently plays part of the symphony.
The North State Symphony. Yep, in the Shasta Symphony. My dad doesn't play a lick, but he appreciates music, he says.
Well, that's good, too. So tell us more about your childhood, what your memories are and the things that you like to do and you didn't like to do.
Yeah. I loved nature. I think that was my refuge in a lot of ways. Loved exploring. We lived way out on the west side of town, and just the peace and beauty of nature and spending a lot of time alone out there. And I think, you know, of course there are memories of family squabbles and parents arguing and then brothers doing this, that, and the other. I think we all coped in different ways. But on the whole, I just so appreciated having such loving and supportive parents towards me, even if they didn't get along. You know, they just really poured that love into us, and honestly grew up loving this area. I think that's part of why I wanted to come back. It's just the accessibility of the nature, the perfect weather, and it's just such a special place.
What do you do when it's 115?
I go to the swimming pool or out to the lake.
What takeaways, what biggest influences did your parents have on you?
I think their exposure, you know, they did the best they could, obviously, with us. But I think their exposure to me of the world, you know, the travel, that I am still in awe that they would give me those opportunities and really encourage that and reinforce that. But then also the grounding in my faith and spirituality, in Christian Science. And such early exposure at that age to the ideas of Mary Baker Eddy, who founded that religion, and just that, you know, God is a loving God, that we're all one, and just really deep ways of looking at the universe, that about transformation, about looking beyond the material picture. It really is a lens through which I look at life. And
so these lenses were the lens that your parents... Right.
Yeah. I'm a third generation. So, you know, we went to church every Sunday. I had to play the piano starting at age 9 for the Sunday school. So I was the piano, Sunday school pianist. We never missed a week.
So I know you played the piano. I know that you won a fiddle championship at age 4. What other instruments do you play?
That's it.
Oh.
Yeah. I play some viola, but...
Well, that's three. Okay, no ukulele.
No guitar, no ukulele.
So you picked up the spiritual foundation from your parents. What other draw would you say that you learned from your parents?
Gosh, these are good questions. I think they are humble. And love others, and, you know, there's no pretense, and they're also incredibly curious, insatiable curiosity and learners, which I've appreciated. And
I mean, you did go to Stanford and in Principia.
Yeah,
Principia. Principia.
Yeah.
Right? Well, these are really high achievement places.
Yeah, both my mom was valedictorian, my dad is a genius. I mean, they're so... really, really smart. And so I think just in the ideas, it wasn't for show. It was just they love learning. They love, you know, we'd go to a museum and I'd be like, oh, seriously, guys? We'd spend all day, you know. And I could have, like, been in there in and out in 10 minutes. And so they just love, they have that amazing curiosity and see the connections of different ideas together. And I think just really appreciating that from them. I think
you also won a speech contest in the fourth
wow,
or fifth.
You did do your homework.
fourth or fifth grade?
Fifth grade, yeah.
The speech contest.
Yeah, the Grant School speech contest. I was up against eighth graders and, you know, junior high, and I did. That was such a, I remember, I still have the plaque from my fifth grade.
Do you remember what the speech was about?
Gosh, I don't actually. I know I won a spelling bee in sixth grade. I remember the word, a county spelling bee. I remember the word I won on, but I can't remember what the speech was about.
Well, what is the word that, well, that's another claim is that you won the spelling bee in the sixth grade, right?
Yeah.
And what word did you win on?
It was emancipation.
Oh, emancipation.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. I'm very, very impressed. You had another experience in a dream while you were in France of seeing yourself somehow attached to the United Nations?
Oh, yeah. Right. So we visited the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And as we, you know, as we were visiting there, I just had, wow, this thought, I would love to work here one day. I loved the ideal behind the United Nations of, you know, one, all these languages, you know, everything's printed in five different languages and all these people, all these nations coming together for the good of the world to solve problems. And
so it struck
beautiful.
You at that age.
Yeah.
But that's in reality what you are working towards.
Yes.
Right.
That is absolutely right. Yeah.
So go ahead and explain more about the
Well, my dream for you, you mean the dream for Euphrates I have?
No, well, tell us a little bit more about this event that came to you in Geneva.
Well, I think having, you know, feeling like an outsider. I mean, I just all growing up, you know, here's my brother who's an other. Then at 12, I'm an other in France and I'm the odd one out, you know. And so I just... You know, this idea of a place where everyone's included, everyone's coming together for good, for this purpose of good. And I think that maybe spoke to me in a new way when I was there. And just, you know, the theme of unity has always been, or inclusiveness or oneness has been throughout my life. And so having... now, I still love the United Nations, but having experienced it very directly through conferences mm-hmm. and as an emissary there with the government, I thought, oh my gosh, the bureaucracy, and it's just totally head intensive. There's no heart. It's all head, no heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've never heard it put that way, but I understand that.
Yeah, they're just not going to move forward on things. But now I feel like what we're building towards is a grassroots United Nations, you know, a group of United citizens. Do we really need nations? We're moving beyond nation states in so many ways, but we still need citizens. And so a grassroots movement of United citizens could be so powerful, thinking about that, you know, us working together on the deepest level to solve problems, to practice the golden rule. Mm-hmm. That would truly change our world.
It's just amazing of the experiences that you had and the influences that you had that directly, to my way of viewing this, directly sent you on a trajectory of where you are right now, which is absolutely just beautiful. So, Janessa, we have taken another quick break, and so we're going to be right back with you. If you're just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5 FM, listener-supported radio. And I'm Henry Cuenca, of course, and my guest today is Janessa Gans Wilder, and we're going to be right back. Thank you. Okay, we're back with our wonderful guest, Janessa Gaines Wilder. And Janessa, you told me at the break that you just recalled a memorable influence. So please share that with us.
Yeah, well, when you were talking about that you see the direct line, and it just came to me. And what I, and maybe it's never even been voiced, and I'm sure my parents don't think of it this way, but they encouraged, I mean, I don't know if they encouraged me or just somehow they modeled it. But anyway, I can honestly say for my entire life, I have never chosen the easy route. That it was all, you know, what they made me do as a kid. You know, I pulled more all-nighters in high school than I did in college, because being at home, they just forced me. You know, I had to go to France. I had to be in every orchestra. I had to take care of my brother. I had to do, like, it was, and then, you know, life was hard. We had chores, and it was, you know, there was difficulty, and there was just a lot going on, and yet I also had to get perfect grades, and I had to do, you know, everything. It was always challenging, mm-hmm. and it always felt like a sink or swim, like you...
Was this self-imposed?
Maybe. I don't know. Uh-huh. I mean, just thinking back to me, though, that I think a lot of it was my parents, because I totally complained about all these different musical things or this or that, or did I really want to go to one more? I mean, it was just like, I remember complaining to my dad about swim practice at 6 a.m. all summer.
Oh, we didn't cover your swim practice.
And he always just replied, it builds character. It builds character. And my mom, you know, really getting back at 11 o'clock and then I have to stay up all night with orchestra. There was never a choice. And even I remember my friends in high school saying, you know, you can say no. Why do you do all this that they make you do? And I didn't think it was a choice. I said, how can you say no? I have to do it. And so I think setting me up in that way of living a life so full, it was just so full, I've just never quit. I've never chosen the easy path. And I don't say that out of ego. I mean, it's just true. Like, that's one thing I can look back on and say I've been faithful in that way and dedicated, that I really do care. I really will sacrifice my own interests and my own needs for some other cause. Like, I really do. I am wired that way. And I think that is because of them.
And Janessa, you know, that's why you're on the show. That is precisely why you are my guest, right?
Wow.
Persistence, right? I have a guest that told me that the heavier the load on a donkey, the faster he runs.
Wow. That's right.
And it sounds like you had a lot of really heavy, heavy loads.
Yeah.
Isn't that a interesting, just a significant observation? Rather than sitting on the porch, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Having a glass of wine,
yeah,
or
exactly.
Twiddling your thumb or whatever. It's absolutely just remarkable. So this has been a very, very interesting time to spend with you. What are you afraid of?
Oh gosh. Afraid of failure, afraid of not living up to my ideals and vision, and not afraid of not doing enough. Or
are you really? Do those things really concern you?
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah, they really. I'm always afraid of not being present enough to my children. You know, that I'm sacrificing their well-being by focusing on this work, mm-hmm. and then. But if I'm only focused on them, then am I not living up to my commitment to the world? And yeah, it's just a constant inner conflict, which is funny because I'm in the business of peace, you know, bridging
yeah,
those divides.
You're trying to create
peace. I'm already divided.
Well, I was going to ask you what you're passionate about, but I think it's pretty obvious. and what do you claim to be your top skills?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. I love ideas. I love inhabiting the world of ideas. I think vision. You know, when I'm clear, I really see the order that already exists in the universe, and that it's just about bringing that out. And I love talking about ideas with others and getting people inspired around those ideas. But I also, I think one of my skills is they have to be action-oriented. It's not just ideas. Like, I love, you know, articulating those ideas and thinking about them, but then how do we make them be, mm-hmm. you know, bring them about?
So you're so that essentially always on a platform.
Huh. Yeah, I guess so. It's interesting.
What do you think about when you wake up in the morning? Is it?
I usually get woken up by my three kids, so I think about
you don't have too much of a choice.
But I'm always thinking about this work when uh-huh. I go to bed, during the day, on my walks. It's such compelling. You know, it really is a mission, mm-hmm. and I love it.
We're convinced of that. Do you have any hobbies? R&R time?
Yes. In nature is my respite, you know, where I really connect. So I run and walk in nature. I do yoga with another one of your former guests, Barbara Nokian. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think movement for me is really important just to relieve stress. Music is a hobby, and then playing with my kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are pretty good thing. Have you ever had any real major catastrophe in your life? A sudden? Doesn't sound like it?
Yeah, I've never lost anyone really. Except for one. Yeah, one of my best friends in college passed on right before our first ever gathering of Euphrates. And Michael Booth is his name. And I think about him almost every day. So he was the closest person to me who's ever passed on. And, you know, for our circle of friends too, it really had an impact. But it just reminds me to be more dedicated and more. He was an incredible human being. And he was one of our first board members
See.
And the board was a huge supporter of this work. And so I carry him with me. But other than that, not really.
If you were to look back over your life, and recalling something, a mistake maybe that you would have done differently, would you find something back in your archives that you say, oh, I should have turned right instead of left?
Yes.
Oh, that was a positive
perspective. And it's something that I don't even think I can, it's such a deep thing that I regret.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes.
Yeah, exactly. That's a whole other show.
And coming to the end of our show, Janessa, and I just wanted to give you some time to maybe express a thought, a fleeting thought that you may have, or something for our listeners, or anything that you wish. So I know you're pretty quick on your feet, so tell us what you would like to end our show with.
Yeah, I feel such gratitude, but I also feel such a sense of urgency about our time right now, that we really are at a tipping point for our planet and for humanity. And so I just encourage anyone listening and anyone in our community just how much to reflect on how much potential and how much power we have as individuals, and to really seize that, you know, to not be complacent, to be dedicated. And I think as we do that, there's just amazing power that can result.
Janessa, welcome to, I'm just appreciate that you came to our show and a guest of mine.
So happy to be here.
And it's just terrific having you in the show. And we do have to break now as our show is closing. And for our listeners, you have been listening to community-supported KKRN 88.5 FM. We are supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. Are you ready to support your local community radio? To become a listener supporter, go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donate button, or mail a check to P.O. Box 818 Montgomery Creek, California. That's 188. You can call 530-337-1101 to volunteer at KKRN Community Radio or learn more. Thank you for listening to The Henry Cuenca Show, where we are in earnest working to make our community and our world a better place. Please tune in to my show each first and third Tuesday of each month at 8 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. You were here. You will listen to another triumphant human story. I would love to hear from you, so please send me an email at henry@kkrn.org or call me directly at 530-356-9811. Thank you for listening.